The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Thursday, the 13th of August, 2020. On the podcast today, Graham Swindell, CEO of Deltic Energy. DELT, ticker there, and Graham discusses the enhanced prospectivity at the Cillian prospect and the processed 3D seismic data of the Pensacola prospect. Also on the podcast, Colin Bird, Executive Chairman of Extract Resources. XTR, ticker, provides a general update on their copper gold production and exploration projects. Plus, Chris Bailey, founder of Financial Orbit, covers news from the following companies: JVC Holdings, TUI, Dignity, and Glenn Goodman, former ITV News business correspondent and now the author of The Crypto Trader, covers this week's Bitcoin, blockchain, and cryptocurrency news. And as always, I have two lists for you, the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs. And there's lots of other content there at foxmarkets.co.uk. We'll all see top 10 visions of those lists, plus our COVID-19 index. What's the biggest rise today? It's Novacyt. No, it's not. It's 4D Pharma, up 10% to 78.9. And the biggest faller is N4 Pharma, down 11% to 11.25. Check that out at voxmarkets.co.uk.
Vox Markets is an online community of investors that runs a free mobile and desktop platform that allows you to track news and updates about any UK-listed company, offering RNS push notifications, detailed charts, pricing data, and much more. Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Graham Swindell, CEO of Deltic Energy. DELT is a ticker there. Graham, thanks for joining me.
No problem. Morning, Justin.
Yeah, it's been a busy week for you. Two bits of news out, significant news, especially the first one we're going to chat about, which is on the P234 license there. Before we get into the news, Graham, as always, just changed the name. For people not familiar or not recognising Deltic, just give us a brief summary of what you're all about, please.
Sure. Well, Deltic's an oil and gas exploration company with an ambition to become one of the UK's leading independent exploration and appraisal companies, with a focus primarily on gas. We've got a portfolio of seven highly prospective licenses in the Southern North Sea gas basin and the Central North Sea. We had a transformational 2019 with Shell farming into two of our licenses, which they're committed to drilling. And we're seeking to build on that success by drilling wells starting next year and continuing to build and grow the company.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of those licenses, like the P2437, the update, they've done enhanced prospectivity at Cillian. So take us through this. It's quite a big upgrade here, isn't it?
Absolutely. We're delighted to be able to announce on Tuesday what's that, 44% uplift in our P50 or mid-case estimate of gas in place, from 437 billion cubic feet to 629, which is the equivalent of, in oil terms, the equivalent of over 100 million barrels of oil, and in the upper case to over 1,000 BCF of gas. In addition to that, the chances of success have been upgraded from 39% to 70%, which is extremely high for an exploration well and more akin to that of an appraisal well. And we're delighted with this ongoing collaboration and work with Shell, which has resulted in this outcome. And I suppose ultimately this uplift in volume of gas coupled with the increased chances of success means that this prospect is even more attractive than we previously thought.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a double whammy. I mean, that 70% now, chance of geological success, of course. But that goes from odds against to odds on, of course, over 50%. So that's very encouraging, isn't it?
Indeed, it is.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so that's a big bit of news there. And also, today, the other license there, 3D seismic processing. Can you take us through the news here, please, Graham?
Sure. Well, again, this morning, very pleased to announce that Shell, the operator of the Pensacola license, has delivered the processed 3D seismic data over Pensacola, which was shot by Shell in Q3 last year, and that's been merged with existing reprocessed legacy 3D data which we had. Importantly, the output from this is that it has delivered a very robust image over the Pensacola prospect, and also means that everything is on track, and that Shell are committed to meeting the timelines under this license. And that means that the contingent well commitment is expected to become firm as anticipated at the end of November, in anticipation of the well being drilled in the second half of next year. So we're very, very happy about that update and the fact that, you know, everything is on track there.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, Graham, and as always, you know what's coming now. Three reasons if someone's lacking the sound of the progress you're making here over these two licenses, but are not yet following the story. Please give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox Markets and add you to their watch list, please.
Okay, well, we've got a fantastic portfolio of seven licenses with the scope to grow further through license awards, which are actually expected imminently. Mm-hmm. We've got a world-class partner in Shell who are committed to drilling Pensacola and then Selene, both of which are very high-impact wells. We have a strong balance sheet, no debt, fully funded for the drilling of those two wells, as well as our working capital requirements through to at least the middle of 2022. And I suppose finally, our shares are trading at around cash and a significant discount to net asset value. So with our high impact prospects, I believe, you know, our company represents a very highly compelling value proposition for investors.
Yeah. And just remind us again, those milestones, the drilling dates all penciled in, when are they happening?
So we anticipate drilling Pensacola in the second half of next year, and Selene will be drilled in 2022.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Big milestones there. And what are you expecting between, you know, then and now? What other bits of news are you hoping to get out there then?
Obviously. Sure. Well, quite a lot happening. Anticipated news flow. We'll be, you know, completing the final technical milestones on Selene. We expect to provide a further update on the results of the seismic at Pensacola. The awards of the UK's latest licensing round are expected imminently, and you know, we submitted an extensive suite of applications there and anticipate being awarded licenses shortly. As far as Pensacola is concerned, we expect that contingent well commitment to be confirmed as being firm as at the end of November. And we haven't really mentioned our other licenses within the portfolio, but subject to market conditions, we see potential for commencement of farm out processes on our Cupertino and Cortez prospects, as well as our Dura oil prospect progressing towards the end of the year.
Yeah, so lots to keep you busy then, Graham.
Yes.
Okay. Thanks for that, Graham. Hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Okay, no problem. Thanks, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Colin Bird, Executive Chairman of Extract Resources. XTR is the ticker there. Colin, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for being invited. Thank you.
Now, you did an update here, a Manika Alluvial Gold and Corporate update yesterday, so we'll dig into that in a bit. But as always, there's many parts of the project, to the company, I mean. So can you just give us a summary as to those parts, please, Colin?
Well, I guess the foundation area is the Manika that we were talking about generally yesterday. That's a gold-producing area that's... It's the exploration hasn't finished yet, but you know, we've got quite a sizable ounce bank spread among a few projects, all of which are either in production, going to be in production, and be it hard rock, be it alluvials, or be it a combination of both. And then, of course, in Zambia, we've got our Eureka project, which is essentially primarily copper with some gold. Then we've got a tailings project at Kalengwa. And of late, we've acquired the Bushranger project, which is a large porphyry west of New South Wales, which has already got 70-odd million tonnes at over 0.5% copper with some gold. Mm-hmm. That broadly is the portfolio.
Yeah, excellent stuff. Okay, so the results yesterday, what's your thoughts on those, Colin?
Well, the thoughts on those, as I said in my little sort of chairman's note there, that... they're pretty much consistent with what's happened the rest of the year. Of course, you're looking at a quarter and you're not breaking it up into months. So you're unable to sort of identify within that. So I made comment to the fact that coronavirus did affect the operations because, you know, we couldn't get stuff out of China. But I'm happy to say the material has reached us from, you know, reached the operation from China. and the operators are doing quite a bit better. But, you know, I also was totally realistic in saying that we're digging quite deep and the grade's quite low, which has been consistent for the whole year. Mm. But nonetheless, an increase of income over expenditure. And you will see with a not too close an examination of those results that we've actually lowered the unit cost per ounce, and we've actually lowered the overall working cost. So that operation is going along, getting better this last month because of the arrival of the new parts. And I'm confident that this month will be more representative than the first 2 months of the quarter. And so we should go along between 8 and 10 kilograms a month at the 100% project level.
Yeah. Okay, let's look at the other projects then. So the hard rock project, what's going on there?
Well, the hard product, you see, the other project we've got, of course, I've referred in the past to the interim, really. It's hard rock and soft dig stuff. As I mentioned, we've got an alluvial project in a nearby concession.
Yeah.
That's waiting for an EIA, which is won't be very long at all. And I expect to have that into production in the next couple of months with another Chinese group. And we're very close to finishing an agreement for a group to come down and work our Guy Fawkes project and our Boa Esperanza. Guy Fawkes is quite a big project. There's well over 1 million tons. And it will be a combination of underground and surface. The good news is that we haven't got to wait for the equipment to come from China. That's already in country. So can't wait to get that project signed and announced. And likewise, there's the bureaucracy of getting the EIA to start the other alluvials. So I'm hoping that production will start shortly. Production will be assembled. The underground adits they'll start to mine. There was some mining down to 50 meters at Guy Fawkes. So they'll be working pillars there and putting a new adit in. So it'll be a combination of surface and underground at Guy Fawkes. And at Boa Esperanza, we will be working probably underground with some surface diggings. And as I say, the good news is the plant's in country. So I'm very hopeful that we'll be able to tell our shareholders that's being commissioned and on its way.
Yeah.
And then as for Fairbride, of course, we have been stymied. I was going to say a little, but it's not a little. We've been stymied by the lockdown of the South African borders. But again, we're doing whatever work we can in country, which will involve tailings dams, which will involve construction of, which will involve the civils. And just as soon as we can, we'll get those big items of equipment and the tower crane up from South Africa. And we're making special arrangements to get our project manager into country to supervise all the preparatory well, not our project manager, our contracting company's project manager into country to supervise all the laying of the foundations, which, of course, that has to be done properly and to a very high standard. Of course, the equipment is heavy, sensitive gearboxes and that, everything's got to be aligned and in place, and so that needs to be overseen. So really, really good news that I'm expecting the second alluvial site to start up in weeks, expecting to announce in the short term, very very short term, our contract with the Chinese group to do our Guy Fawkes and Boa Esperanza. And whilst we are a little stymied with the virus, once I get it all clear, we're only 4 months away from 4 months away from building the Fairbride hard rock. And the Fairbride hard rock, of course, will encompass Dart's Luck, which is another project within the concession. So we're very happy about that. It's all systems go.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about Bushranger, Copper Gold in Australia, of course. Where are you with that? Have you done your due diligence there?
yeah, we've done our due diligence, of course, before we signed the deal. But you know, that's kind of tight kicking due diligence, and the real due diligence has been going on since. That's why always when I do these deals, Justin, you know, that we ask for a due diligence phase, because the tire kicking can only excite you. It's the it's the real stuff that depresses you. Mm-hmm. And I'm happy to say we've not found any of that. What are we waiting for now? We're waiting for the Foreign Investment Board to give us the final permission, Australian Investment Board. What shareholders have all agreed, so that on the other side, to transfer the shares, all titles and are in place. Agreements with Anglo American are in place, because Anglo American, as you know, have got a backing right, so they're in place. So no big worries there. And I'm absolutely pleased with the sort of technical due diligence. Had a real good look at the work what's done in the past, you know, and well beyond tie kicking. And those last three holes, they were crackers, and you know, long intersections in this porphyry, showing good copper values. And the gold, as they got deeper, we of course we weren't involved. The gold values, I mean, I think if I recall, there's some gold values as high as 11 grams, but certainly twos and threes. So this is a real copper gold porphyry. And not unusually for the district, gold values do increase with depth. And of course, we've got another porphyry which is showing all the signs. It's called Foot Rot. I think we might change the name of that one. It sounds a bit smelly, doesn't it? Yeah. So Foot Rot, we got that one. And there's a couple of three epithermals with companies have been reporting in that Lachlan trend, as they call it. Companies have been reporting good gold discoveries, and we got three of those to sort of in our portfolio to test. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we're planning the drill campaign. We're putting our applications to drill with a New South Wales environmentalist. And all in all, I think, well, I mean, to summarize it, Justin, I think timing is everything in life, mm-hmm. and certainly in our business it is. And that would be a difficult deal to get hold of if we try and get it now. So yeah. I'm delighted for our shareholders that we've managed to get this deal. And it's a diversion. It's a different country. But, you know, I wasn't going to sit and watch a project of that size with that much potential go wasting and seize the opportunity. You know, a few days of soul searching. Do we really want to work in Australia? Isn't that a distraction? But I tell you what, 71 million tonnes. Already about 130,000-140,000 tonnes of copper proven according to 2012 JORC resource with gold values including. I didn't have to search my soul for too long before I decided our shareholders must have the benefit of this one.
Yeah. Is that, I mean, if it's possible, they're all your sort of babies, I suppose, but is that the one you are most excited about or what?
Try not to be, Justin. Try to get a balanced project and maintain a balanced view on that project. Yeah. I've got a personal style where I keep in my head, I keep a league table.
Yeah.
And I'm not frightened as I go along life's way to adjust that league table. So it's not difficult in my mind to go from the top of the league to the bottom of the league. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, we're in a very competitive space for attention, for money. And you can't think, let's drill another hole, tomorrow will be better. Or you can't think, let's let those contractors dig over there, I'm sure there's some gold. You really have got to be specific of which part of your portfolio gives you the best short-term advantages. Because we're not blessed like the majors, the really big BHPs and Rios, where we can look for the next 20 years. We've got a satisfied market which is here today. Mm. And delivery is very, very important. You know, you've only got to visit the bulletin boards, and all the time is the shareholder, retail shareholder, constant need for delivery against projections, and that's the space we're operating in. And that's, you know, basically that if you that's the space we're operating in, that's the space, and that's the way we've got to think, and that's the way I do think. I've been out about 20 years in the space.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Colin, just a reminder, there's a lot to ingest there, lots of information, a lot of projects going on. So for someone listening right now who likes the sound of what you're doing but are not yet following the story, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Fox and add Extract Resources to their watch list, please.
Well, it's in the right commodities, copper and gold. Mm-hmm. It's got a combination of production and blue sky exploration in Eureka and Bushranger. Production, Manika, Eureka, and Kalengwa. And if you look at the prospects versus the market cap, massive disconnect. That's why I would get a position now in Extract Resources.
Excellent stuff. Colin, good to chat to you as always, and hopefully we'll catch up in the not-too-distant future. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Justin.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Chris Bailey, founder of FinancialOrbit.com. You all right, Chris?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Very, very busy as per normal. Earnings season rolls on.
Yeah, regardless of the heat. It's cooled down a bit today where I am. I don't know if it's like where you are, but
Yeah,
it feel like you, you know, some kind of giant standing next to me, breathing all over me. So hot, the air was just so claustrophobic. But now the giant has moved away. It's even a bit of rain last night. It's cooled down. It's still a bit close, but yeah, it's better, isn't it? It's like it can actually operate normally. Okay, so companies announcing. Who's up first?
Well, let's start with the easier one, which is GVC. So back in the FTSE 100, GVC, obviously well-known gambling entity. They a few years back bought Ladbrokes and Coral, but they've got a bunch of online brands and, you know, one of the bigger betting names in the world now. They've come out with some numbers. Still seeing, you know, these are first half numbers. So they cover the sort of the pandemic period. And even though all of their online operations grew like stink, clearly betting shops weren't open, people weren't going out, etc. They're still doing that transition. So their net gaming revenue, which was also clearly impacted by the lack of football and other sport to bet on too, was down 10%, and their EBITDA was down, I think it was about 5%. So, yeah, no absolute disaster at all. But they've been talking about the recovery, talking about, again, the ongoing shift to online, which was happening before the pandemic, clearly got a big boost throughout the pandemic and will continue apace. But also about opportunities they see in the States. And one thing I like about this whole space, and it's something which a William Hill and a Paddy Power, a Flutter as they're now called, instead of Paddy Power, have also talked about, is that, you know, for once, Europe is ahead of the States and actually helping some of the big US casino and related operators with their own push into sports betting and various online activities as sort of gambling liberalization occurs over there. So some positive chat about technology shifts in the US as well in the statement, as well as sort of synergies from effectively, sadly, closing, you know, a bunch of Ladbrokes betting shops and related. So overall, solid set of numbers. They've edged up their full-year EBITDA guidance, which can obviously generally be no bad thing. They're not paying a dividend because, as with many companies, they want to err slightly on the side of caution. You know, the one pushback on this company is because of some of those deals, they do have a debt burden. In my opinion, it's not super excessive, but it's full. And even though I think inherently they're a cash generative business, they want to chivvy that debt pile down a bit before I think they bring the dividend back, which I think is probably pretty sensible. But overall, even though it's obviously betting on, by definition, the propensity of gamblers to go out and effectively lose money whilst hopefully having a good time and everything else, you know, when the fun stop betting and all of that, I think GVC is actually well placed and, you know, still I think offers some appreciation scope. So I felt a supportive kind of set of comments today. I still think on my numbers and my hope that it's going to blast through the historic resistance at around £9 a share and perch up at £10 a share at some point in the sort of the not too distant future.
Yeah, well, so I'm surprised considering the lack, you know, I've had, you said most gambling revolves around sport, I suppose. Or a lot of it is sport and events, you know, horse racing, football, all that stuff. And considering that that's effectively stopped for a month or so, they've only dropped like 10%. And like, well, I suppose that's, you know, 6 months. Was it, how long was lockdown for? Was it 2 months or?
Well, I mean, if you think about it, football and horse racing, yeah, was 2 to 3 months, wasn't it? I mean,
it's not a massive drop in their revenue, really, is it? So obviously, areas, you know.
Yeah, you've got casino, got sort of, you know, what was it, Belarusian football and Polish ice hockey and other stuff like that.
I suppose people will gamble on anything if it's there, you know. It's like, what's moving? Let's look at, how fast will paint dry? Let's gamble on that. It comes down to, you know, if they can't gamble on the sport of their choice, they'll just go for something else. But I do have a problem. I spent a bit of time as manager of bookies years back, and I didn't like it, and I just found it... The people gambling, to me, I don't see a lot of people enjoying it. It's like they're almost addicted to it. I have a problem with it, just on an investment standpoint. Same with tobacco companies. I want to invest in tobacco companies, you know. So,
it's a fair point. I think, though, my observation, I do invest in both those areas, and the way I've rationalised it for the gambling companies is that what I'm seeing, a bit like what I saw with tobacco 20 plus years ago, is that they're coming into the fold. And GVC, you know, the pushback on them is that they've had all sorts of strange dealings in places like Turkey, sort of strange stuff. There's still an ongoing investigation with the HMRC and related. So it's been an area a bit like tobacco was a generation ago, where lots of sort of, in quotes, interesting things were going on. There was a bunch of different lawsuits and litigation and other sort of long-term liability threats. But a bit like tobacco, the gambling space is working out. You've got to work with regulators and governments, which is why you end up with, quite correctly, obviously all the advertising now with the line, you know, when the fun stops, stop gambling and all of that, and other restrictions that are coming in and various other disclosures. So I think that is the sort of the route forward for the industry. Can it still be profitable? Absolutely, as you've seen with tobacco, coming under sort of the government's regulatory fold is actually generally quite highly profitable because the government's interested in maximising tax revenues, and what it tends to do is oligopolise the industry. And that's what you're seeing, you know, the GVCs, the William Hills, the Flutters, etc. If you go back a few years, there was a myriad of companies in this space, particularly as online opened up. So, yeah, you've got to make a moral judgment on it. That is a fair point. As you know, if you have, I think it's quite interesting as a space.
Yeah, cool. Okay, what's next? The next company with news out, Chris?
Well, let's go from a company which is, I guess, questionable but profitable, to one which is, I guess, most people would like, which is the travel company TUI, because it's good times and holidays and sun and everything else. But unfortunately, with financial results which are unsurprisingly lousy at the moment, TUI obviously coming out of the old sort of TUI Travel, Thompson Hotels and Thompson Group and everything else, sort of an Anglo-German combination nowadays, whacking losses in both the quarter two numbers and the half one period as they reported today. So put a couple of numbers on it. 1.1 billion EBIT loss in the last quarter. Actually, the 9 month loss that they reported today of a cool 2 billion euros. So massive losses. And when you think about it, the company's market cap is not much bigger than that 2 billion euro loss. You can sort of see that it's a very sort of strange moment, as you would expect. They talked about obviously some recovery, but hotel occupancy still very, very negligible. Of the hotels I've opened, they've only got occupancy of 23%, but most striking probably is the revenue line. The revenue line is down 98% in the period last reported on, which says everything, really. It's clearly very tough times. So the whole results are sort of centred on their bounce-back strategy. Their view of life is... clearly, it's a super difficult period at the moment. That their full year ends in September. This year is going to be horrible. They've taken extra support, particularly from the German government, to get them through. And they talk a little bit in the results about the extra billion and change support from the Germans, which is fair enough. But they're talking about 2021 as sort of a bounce back year, and 2022 as a, and I quote, a normalization year. So that's the year where everything goes back back to normal. So you heard it here first. TUI have called it. 2 years until their results are back to being fully normal. Suffice to say, if they're right about that, shares are unbelievably cheap. If they're wrong about that, or they get the timing a bit awry, this is super geared into everything, basically. So it's either, it's a classic kind of double or quits type thing. It's either going to struggle to service its liabilities over the next year or two, or alternatively, it's going to double or triple and still obviously be at a fraction of its level of a couple of years ago or so. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know, interesting times. It's a very super macro play. Hard to know what to feel other than it is a company which is going to be a direct beneficiary, or it's going to struggle depending on how things work out.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the thing that's striking, if you look at the chart here, is that, you know, if people weren't aware of this company, they think the fall was just due to COVID. But, you know, in 16th of May 2018, they're at, 18 quid a share. And they've, you know, they've just grinded lower for like a year, year and a half. They had a bounce around mid, they went down to 8 quid by, in June of 2019. They bounced up above 10 quid. But then, of course, we had December come around, end of 2019, then we had COVID come in, and it dropped down again to like, what, 3.50 now it is. But so they, you know, it's not just a current recent fall. They are the worst performing the FTSE, I think, for the last year and a bit. So so it's not just the COVID issue, is it, that they have issues with? And maybe they'll, this will make them do that restructure, do whatever they need to do to get efficient again. But like I said, if it's going to be, I think a vaccine, if you get a vaccine in this year, of course, even the news, I know it's not going to be, you know, spread around or promulgated around, shared around the world in within a year. It would take a lot longer than that. But even the news that should give all sort of travel holiday companies a bit of a boost technically at the share price. But like I said, you know, will they last till, many companies, I suppose, will last till 2022 unless they have significant uptick in the bookings. So you get a technical bounce, yes, but, you know, they still need the money coming in, don't they, you know?
Yeah, that's why 2021, next year for them, the year to September next year, is super critical. So too early to say already about winter and summer booking trends, which will be the sort of the early indicator. That will come a bit more coherently over the following few months. That's the thing to watch. But yeah, that's the key. They've got to stabilise the ship over the next year, so stop bleeding cash effectively, and then that gives them the chance of moving back to sort of these normalised hopes for 2022. Today, it surely can only be a watch, because, you know, if you fancy gambling money, we're just talking about the gambling space, but this is a gambling stock, I guess, in the purest sense, which is, it's very much dependent on exogenous things. The fact that the German government has decided to provide more support is helpful, but ultimately, as with all government support, another bout of it may come with more exacting terms. And, you know, that may ultimately include equity shareholder stakes, dilution and everything else. So, you sort of see it in comments by some of the bus and train companies here as well. And I think to myself, yeah, they're getting the support, but at what point does that flip over into, hang on, guys, you know, you can't actually, if this is all this is doing is ultimately providing your shareholders with profits and dividends, is that right? And that's the thing. There'll always be some trade-off for such support. And,
Is there a chance, sir, that I said, if we get this kind of announcement, there's a vaccine, you know, obviously the Russians have come up with a thing, a successful vaccine, we ignore that for now. But, you know, when a properly qualified vaccine comes out, that the share prices will rally on a lot of these beaten down travel and leisure stocks, and then maybe another round of equity, you know, fundraising. Yeah. So, because that was at a higher level, you know.
Absolutely. Well, we've seen that already, haven't we? Mm. We saw that in the case of, let's say, some of the... Take EasyJet, for example. Yeah. Their shares rose... Actually, EasyJet bogged up the timing slightly.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
Because their shares were pushing towards 9 or 10 quid. And they waited, or they were putting it together or whatever else. And they actually did it a month or so later when the shares were 2 or 3 quid lower. Mm. So I think the answer is absolutely. And we had, I say, a flirtation with that sort of period in early June, where a lot of the travel and leisure stocks were at significantly higher levels than they are today. You know, what's changed since? Well, you know, we've had some sort of fears about the second wave. We've had some of the reality of the results and everything else, which have you know, overhung the shares. But yeah, markets look forward. Any news of, you know, a second wave that is transitory, doesn't really exist, as you say, a vaccine or some other sort of residual hope. These are pure plays on that effectively. So the shares will rally first, people will ask questions second. Yeah. But you're right. Surely into any significant rally, they are going to want to put their balance sheets on an even firmer footing. Yeah. And that obviously then ultimately could cap the recovery, just because you would then be diluting people. But if you're a shareholder, surely you'd want to participate on the basis that it just embeds your chance that ultimately there is a sort of a go at this normalized 2022 earnings and everything else, which would play into ultimately a share price recovery.
Yeah, cool. Okay, what's next, Chris? Anything else?
Well, we've got to have a quick one on the a little bit morbid to say this, but the funeral space, particularly thinking about Dignity here, FTSE 250 company, the space and the Dignity stock has been under big pressure over the last 2 or 3 years. A bunch of reasons why, but one of them was an investigation into the area where it was suggested that there was not particularly competitive underlying dynamics to the industry, and that pricing was well ahead of inflation and matters like that. And obviously it's an area which sadly all of us at some point are going to have to sort of utilize the services of at some level. So, you know, it matters for all consumers. It's kind of interesting. The CMA, the Competition and Markets Authority, they've come back today with their preliminary view. And what they've said effectively is they see all these problems. They see the fact that prices are above inflation. They see the fact that competitive conditions are very mixed, and that basically the funeral providers have not been very good at giving people options and have tended, because of, you know, the difficulty of the moment, people don't want to discuss the range of options to any great extent. A lot of people have bought basically expensive funerals for their loved ones or maybe for themselves, and clearly that's not optimal. So they've said all of that, but they've also said because of the coronavirus, because of the issues around the sector at the moment, high demand and everything else, they're not suggesting any of their recommendations or instincts are actually applied in terms of trying to shake the industry up. So at some level, it's a bit of a cop-out, to be honest. They've kind of said, we see the problems, but we're not going to do anything about it for the moment. Yeah. And as you would expect, Dignity shares, there when I last looked, they're up 6 or 7%.
They're up 26% now.
They're up 26% now. There you go. Well, obviously, I was looking at a slow feed or something.
Well,
or
yeah, I think people are just catching on to it. Look at the chart here. They're literally... At COVID, they're at five, well, just shy of £6. They dropped down to like 250, sub that, bounced around, and now they're almost back at £5. So they're almost back to pre-COVID levels. You know?
But here's my observation. Number one is they've dodged a bullet here. Yes, metaphors are difficult here, but the CMA's pronouncement could have been a lot worse for them. Let's put it that way. I would observe, though, that this industry is now scot-free, because clearly their card has been marked. And number two, there's been such bad publicity for this space over the last 2 or 3 years. Guess what's happened? The market has started to work, and the number of alternative providers, internet-centered providers that there are out there today, I think it's changing the market. So my feeling would be this is a relief bounce. This is a relief bounce on, it could have been so much worse. But here's the reality. The genie is out of the bottle on this space, in my opinion. So, yeah, if you own Dignity stock, you're probably celebrating today. But have a deep think about what this really means. And I'm sorry, but it's not going back to the wondrous share price levels of 3 or 4 years ago. I just think this space, card's been marked, it's changing, internet competition is coming in. We all need to use it, but we also, unsurprisingly, you know, where more efficient, more price aware options are put in front of people, they're going to shift and move towards them, just as we've seen in a bunch of other consumer-facing, consumer sort of spending areas.
Yeah, cool. Marvellous stuff. I know we'll all be a customer sooner or later, but I'm surprised. I mean, the last set of results, you know, weren't... I had them on the watch list. I only put them on my watch list. You know, left as COVID came around. So, right, let's, if the body count is going to go up, you know, someone's going to be a benefactor of that. And but their last set of results weren't that bad, actually, were they? I'm looking now. Revenue, underlying revenue up 9%. Underlying profit before tax up 11%. Operating profit. So, yeah, so, you know, it's all sort of ticking up. And I thought, but of course, that depends how many excess deaths there are, I suppose. But like I said, it's really temporary. But before that, I assumed the figures weren't that good. And I just thought, if you're in an industry where you've got a constant flow of customers, you know, willing or not willing, then and you can't be profitable or efficient, then there's no hope for you, really, is there? You know.
Well, this is the thing. I think it was very much sold as a utility business,
yeah.
And with great customer loyalty, in the sense that if people use one provider for perhaps say a local provider, there was great sort of market share maintenance, if I can put it that way.
Yeah.
But I think the trouble is that flipped over into overly firm pricing and a lack of competition and everything else. So I think the internet is sorting this out, and I think it will sort it out actually probably without much need for the CMA ultimately. But yeah, they have fudged the issue big time, I think, this morning.
Yeah, marvellous stuff. And, you know, it's nice to end on dignity, because that's where a lot of people do end up, you know, contacting those guys. So. Lovely, Chris. Thanks for that. We'll speak you next weeky.
Sounds a plan. See you then.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
Joining me on the podcast right now is Glenn Goodman. He is the author of The Crypto Trader. But, you know, he's a trader, so it's not just crypto, is it, Glenn?
No, it's not. It's a great pleasure to be here today, Justin.
Wow, you've had a near-death experience.
It's always a great pleasure to be.
Oh, you went to Clacton, didn't you?
On your podcast.
Is that the same?
Yes, I did. I went to Clacton yesterday.
Clacton. But do you know what you said? You said it was very nice. Surprise! You said it was very nice, apparently. But the name Clacton and Skegness, we got some awful names for our, you know, seaside resorts. So Bognor Regis. It sounds like something you'd find. You know, well, it sounds like a block drain or something. Bognor Regis is that the stuff you'd find in a drain? Yeah, it's got it's full of Bognor Regis. That is, we got to get that out. Otherwise, you'll mess up your whole system.
And Skegness,
again, Skegness is something you'd find in the. You'd be pulling out your drains, you know. It's
and it also, Skeggy.
What you got? Like, yeah. What you got in there, son? This is a proper, you know, a plumber or someone who deals with drains. Yeah. What you got in there? You got a bit of Bognor, a bit of Skeggy, and a bit of Clacton. So we got a chemical that will shift all that. But we just need to rename them, remarketing, because, like you said, it's very nice, wasn't it? Well, quite nice.
It was very pleasant. It was. I mean, there was perfect weather. The beach was just lovely. The sea was nice. My wife kept saying that felt like we were on holiday abroad.
Yeah.
You know, but like you say, I'd never been to Clacton before. And like you, I kind of had those associations in my head. Oh, it's going to be a bit scummy. You know, just like, you know, rubbish everywhere is the kind of image you have in your head. There's going to be all litter. But no, it was perfect. Lovely place.
Yeah.
I recommend it highly.
Right,
but not on a weekend. Only during the week. On a weekend, it would be too crowded, I reckon, because it was all right yesterday. But I'm going on too long, aren't I?
Yeah.
Is that what's happening?
Here? You often do that.
Yeah.
No. Okay. So that's the first tip. That's the first idea. Go to Skeggy. Clacton.
Yeah.
But not on the weekend.
Not on the weekend.
And also, surprise, you go to coast. It's not as stiflingly hot and humid, you know, as inland. Like yesterday,
oh,
we were
right.
34 degrees. It felt like sort of a big fella just breathing on me all the time. You know, really close to me. It's like get away, and that claustrophobic. But like, anyway, three big brothers.
You should ask that bloke to leave your house. Probably.
Yeah, no, three triplets, big. Hefty fellas, you know, overweight, sweating, standing right next to me and then breathing on me. That's what I felt like all day. Just felt like that claustrophobia there. Anyway, so...
Yeah, on the beach, yeah, it was nice and cool because of the sea breeze, yeah.
Yeah. Right, so what's happening this week then? Have you been trading or did you... When you take a day away from the trading desk, are you put them on sort of manually or are you automated? How do you do that?
Yeah, I set some automated orders to buy or to have stop losses in place for my existing orders. I try not to check prices during the day if I'm, say, out at the beach or whatever, but sometimes I can't resist. There were a few times I had to check. But that's just me being pathetic and sort of breaking my own rules, really, because there is no need. Once you've set your orders, if you're a long-term trader, then, you know, you can do most of your work at night, or in the evenings, rather, like I used to do when I worked at the BBC and at ITV. When I was a TV reporter, I used to just do my stuff at the weekends and in the evenings, set my buy orders, set my stop losses, and then, you know, theoretically, you don't need to look at the prices during the day. That's the idea.
Yeah. All right, then, so what are you in at the moment? Anything? Are you long anything?
Yeah, I am. Not too many things, but in cryptocurrencies, I'm still long Bitcoin and Ethereum. Though, having said that, by the time this podcast goes out, there's a chance that I might be out. I've been in for weeks, regular listeners may remember, some weeks now, and, you know, so the profits have been building up because cryptocurrencies have been rising pretty consistently for weeks now, some of them by enormous amounts, some of the smaller ones. So I have some holdings in smaller cryptocurrencies, like one called Compound, which has been doing very well, one called Coty, which has been doing very well, and when I say doing very well, you know, some of these cryptocurrencies are up several hundred percent over a matter of weeks. Obviously, I wish I'd put more money in them, but it's very much like AIM stocks, which obviously a lot of your listeners trade, in the sense that they can go up by huge amounts, but you don't want to put too much money in them because they're so volatile that when they fall, they could also fall by, you know, 30% in a few hours, that kind of thing. So Compound is one that I put some money into, but as I say, not as much as I would have liked in with hindsight, as is always the way. There's one called DGB. Well, that's the code for it. If you keep
someone's
an eye
been
on that,
ramping
that's
that. Someone's been trying to ramp me into that for years.
Really?
Is it Digibyte? What's it called?
How did you know about that one then?
Well, because they've been tweeting me for literally very, it must be at least 12 months. I tend to ignore because I'm not into crypto, of course. I was a little bit into Bitcoin, but that's about it. But they kept saying, this is the one to get into. Honestly, this can be massive and all that stuff. But
they first say that, though, out of interest?
Must have been more than 12 months ago. These are guys now that have, you know, their Twitter icons, I think maybe even involved in some way, I don't know. Their Twitter, you know, avatars are Digibyte's sort of logo. So
those kind of people, right, yeah.
So they've been...
I'm familiar with such people. Well, actually, if you had bought when they told you to, if it was more than a year ago, you would have watched 2/3 to 3/4 of your money drain away in the months following them telling you to buy it. And, you know, most people would be shaken out by that, probably you included, I suppose. It's very, very hard to sit through most of your money, your original capital, disappearing and getting no profit at any point in the trade whatsoever. But since then, they bottomed in March, as did a lot of other cryptocurrencies, and have been rising very strongly since then. So, in fact, if you had bought when those people told you to, you'd probably have doubled your money by now. But in the meantime, you would have had to lose most of it first. Yeah. So, you know, these are trades that sound great in hindsight. As I say, if you'd bought a year ago, you'd have doubled your money. But in the meantime, nearly everybody would have sold out because it's so hard to stay through a process where you see no end to your money just disappearing and disappearing.
Yeah, in projects like that that have questionable value, or you know, they do have value, because they may have value, but you can't see it because it's all in the future. You don't know what, you know, it's based on a tech that we don't know whether it's going to be adopted or not. So it is a punt. But
it is, far, it's just hope and fear is driving it.
Exactly. With companies, it's a different thing, though. I mean, I don't know if you've read that book. Have I talked about this book to you? It's called 100 Baggers by Christopher Mayer. These are companies of to study. It's re sort of hash or an updated version of a book written by a previous author that he liked so much. He liked him so much that he's credited him in the book, but I doubt if he gives him any profits. But it's an updated version of an older version. But they looked at 365 companies that have 100 bagged, and the first thing they start off with is you can't emphasize this point enough, is that if you want to make real money, trading is not the way forward, because you trade on margins, you know, 20%, 30%, 100%, whatever. If you want to make real money, you buy at the right price and you hold through ups and downs. That's the way you would have got 100 or 1,000 bag on Amazon and some of that, but not many people do it, of course. But there's plenty of examples in there. Like one of them, he talks about Potash of Saskatchewan. He bought like a $2 and he held on for, I think it was about 5-6 years. It did like 100 bags. No, he did. He did 4 bags, I think. He 4 times his money. And he said, I thought I did pretty well. If I'd held on for another 5 years, I'd done 100 bags. And if I bought like a year earlier, I'd done 200 bags. And so it's by buying right, and he keeps saying, buy right and hold on. It's like almost a coffee can approach. If you want to get true multiples of your money, investing is the way forward. Trading, you're just looking for a small percentage profit all the time. And then
you have to buy quite a lot of those though to get a 100 bag. This is the problem with that theory, is it's kind of like gambling at a casino in the sense.
But what he says
is gambling on high odds.
Hang on.
Betting on a lot of forces that are long shots.
No, hang on.
All right, go on.
So what he says, if you they looked for certain traits, okay, and there's a lot of traits in there.
Yeah, they've got their traits.
No, because they will, because the companies can be scalable, and they've got a lot of them are owner-owned, but it's run, businesses. But he said, even if you find these filters, generally you get a good return anyway, because you're looking at the value of a company, projected value, all that thing. You may not get 100 bags, but you'll get a good return, better than the average stock market return anyway. So, it's about looking at quality companies, essentially, that are undervalued. One may go on to be a 100-bagger, whether it may just go on to be a 2-bagger, but a 2-bagger is still very good, and a lot better you would get than just, having your money in a bank somewhere. So
2-bagger is great, but, as any AIM investor knows, and I've done, enough AIM investing in my life, and you've done more than me, probably, but the point about it is that, even if you do all your due diligence, you're still not there inside the CEO's head. You still don't know what they're holding back from you. There are so many unknowns that basically, if you do all your due diligence and you invest in, say, 10 very promising looking companies, chances are still that 5 of them will fall in value, and they might not necessarily go bust, but they might just slowly decline over a number of years, for example, with your money tied up in them. Then maybe you get another 4 that rise kind of nicely and steadily, and then maybe you get 1 out of those 10 that is a big success, and if you're lucky, that will make up for all the losses on the 5 that went down.
I think you've got to adjust and apply your own filters as well. Because I've been evolving my filter. I've got a filter system, and the acronym is Schedules, and it fits that thing. And it's hard. It's easy coming up with it, because I looked at winners and losers, and I look where I've gone right and where I've gone wrong, and I've applied this filter. Now, sticking to it is something different. You get tempted. Your emotions get tempted at other things. But there's certain things you can apply that will stop you losing money, and that's in my filter. And every time I go outside the filter, I thought, why have I done that? So you can do it. I mean,
you can increase your odds. Absolutely, I totally agree with you.
I've had about in the last 11 years, I've had over 60 bags. And that's I've had 3 10-baggers, and that's by looking at, and you take lessons from that, But those weren't, even those 10-baggers weren't sustainable. Now, I've adjusted my filter to look at sustainable companies, and that means companies, you only get sustainable rises in companies when they're generating real value, and real value is cash. Now, if you want to get a pop and drop, and you can, a couple of those companies I've invested in were pop and drops, 10 bag pop and drops, so you get massive pop and drops, but you've got to get out, and you can't just stay in there, because there could be resource companies that, come up with a massive find, excellent grades, but will they ever get it out of the ground? Probably not. It's probably dodgy jurisdiction, they probably wouldn't get debt funding, and take a lot longer to get more grades out with the build up to a resource where it's worth creating a mine around. So then it comes back, the reality sets in. So the hope, hype, potential of these pre-revenue stocks can be massive. Like I said, it can be 10, 20 baggers, but sooner or later it will come back. Now, I want to hold on to the company essentially for 10 years and they keep going up every year. Sustainable, nice, solid, steady rise rather than just a, you know, accelerated, crazy rise and then a drop off. And you have to get out and everyone's exiting, trying to sell, and you end up rushing for the exit like everyone else. So I don't want to do that. So, yeah, so you can find.
Yeah, I mean, it can be very difficult to work out what is a genuine sustainable rise in a name.
What is just a pump and dump?
Well, no, it's not because
they've got to be close to cash generation. And you look at the end markets, is the end markets big enough and commercial enough? Not just big, but commercial. Because they can't just say a high tech company that's, oh, this is going to be massive. So there's two proofs of concept. Does their tech work? Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Now, is the demand for their tech and big growing demand? If it's not, doesn't matter how good the tech is, if no one really wants it, then it's not going to be commercial and sustainable. So if you say resource companies are always, you know, quite good to, you could get seriously 10, 20, 30, 100 baggers out of them, because the stuff they're selling is not a, you know, it's a no-brainer. You know, people need copper. But always people need copper. There's always a market for that stuff. So as long as they've got the resource and they can get the debt funding and all that stuff and they've got demand for it, it's going to do well from where they are. But again, getting it's something like only 5% of exploration companies, less than 5% of exploration companies to start exploring get to become an actual producer. You know, so
well, this is why when you're investing in AIM stocks, you need to have quite a large raft of companies that you've bought into simultaneously, or not necessarily simultaneously, but you need to be spreading your risk across a bunch.
Because you don't know which ones are necessarily
going to become the big winners.
No, because selective though as well.
Selective helps.
Resource stocks. I've got 7 companies, and I think I'm probably in. But no, oh my God, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 companies, and I think I'm probably in about too many, because I know exactly now what I'm looking for. You know. It's just being patient. So anyway, Bitcoin. Yes,
we've got. Well, anyway, but no, the small cryptocurrencies are very much, you know, the same kind of thing. If you buy small cryptocurrencies, then yeah, you do your due diligence. You try and improve your chances of getting a big future winner. But ultimately, you know, it rests in the hands of not just the management of whatever organization or company has set up that cryptocurrency, but also, of course, in the people, the masses. Will they latch onto that particular technology? And also, will people start buying the cryptocurrency itself in greater numbers? There, you know, these are some of the unknowns. And that's why, you know, I do buy smaller cryptocurrencies. I'm quite selective about them, but I try and spread my risk among, you know, a number of them, so that hopefully I will grab onto at least one of the winners. And yeah, and I've done that with a few of the ones that I've mentioned. But yeah, DGB, as the one that you've been told to buy over and over again, is on a sort of upward rip now. It's only just started by the looks of it. Hopefully it has more gas in the tank at the moment. I'm not in it yet. That's the one that I'm watching very carefully. And I'm waiting for the current. It's doing the sideways ranging, forming a pattern type thing. So I'm waiting for that to kind of reach its crescendo until it looks like it's ready to pop. And then when it breaks out, hopefully I'll be there ready and waiting to buy it. I might place a stop buy order, but with cryptocurrencies, it's a little bit more dodgy than it is on some of our native exchanges when you're just, you know, trading stocks and shares. When you're doing cryptocurrencies, having a buy stop in place. There aren't many exchanges where you can have a buy stop in place and simultaneously a stop loss at the same time. So if my buy stop triggers and suddenly I'm in the thing and then it reverses and the price shoots downwards, then I wouldn't have a stop loss in place if I'm using one of the big exchanges. And that's a problem.
So of course the algorithm, the computer code, so it has to see you have a long in there to put a sell, a buy in there to put a sell in, I suppose. But you can do it straight away after, can't you? Within seconds.
Yeah, but what if I'm asleep when the buy stop order triggers?
So you automated buy stop. Yeah, that's the trouble. So and you can't do that. So who does that and who doesn't do that then?
Well, at the moment, I think they keep changing, but Kraken, which is one of the biggest cryptocurrency exchanges, that allows you to do that one at the moment, which is good. But the downside there is that they're a slightly smaller exchange. They don't trade quite as many cryptocurrencies. You know, they don't necessarily have the ones that you're looking for if you're looking for little tiny cryptocurrencies. Whereas Binance, which is by far the biggest exchange in the world, has got hundreds of cryptocurrencies that you can trade, but they don't seem to offer that order at the moment. And generally, the reason given when exchanges take away order possibilities that they used to give you, like being able to place a buy stop order with a stop loss simultaneously, when they take away those kind of orders, it's usually because they say it's slowing their system down. You know, I don't quite understand how exactly that works, but they all seem to say the same thing when they remove them. We've had to remove this order and that order, and one cancels the other order and whatever, because it was making our system slow during peak times. And this is something that, of course, that all exchanges struggle with, is handling order flow at peak times. And you've probably seen, you know, even traditional stocks and shares websites go down sometimes under those conditions.
Yeah, do you believe that what they're saying, or do you think they just say it because people tend to, they make less money if they put those kind of things in place?
Well, they all seem to say it, as I say. They all make that excuse that it slows everything down if they have too many different order possibilities. Maybe it's when you have these combined orders, I suppose, you end up with a lot more orders on the system if people are, you know, just sitting there on the system. And I guess then you get a lot more orders triggering simultaneously as a result. So I guess they're keen to not have too many people setting orders in advance. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah, well, if you think of it in just logic, it's like if you put an automated buy order, if this and this is the code. So if this hits this level, then you buy. Now, they've actually added an extra line of code there, haven't they? If this happens, then this happens, you fill. And then this happens, and this happens. So it's double the amount of code, I suppose it is. So it would, you know, computers just going through a lot of that, millions of those, would, I suppose, slow it down, wouldn't it? You know,
but perhaps so. Maybe somebody who understands the technology better than we do could send us a tweet and let us know.
No, don't do that.
No? Okay.
It's boring, boring text or paragraph I've ever read in my life, that would be.
Right. The reason you were partly right on this, but let me just point out different lines of code.
Oh, God.
I want to know the answer, and just, you know, for that listener who's composing their tweet right now, I just want you to know, I don't think you sound like that impression that Justin just did.
No, I don't. I'm very offended by that, actually.
Okay, well, any news on Bitcoin? Anything happening? Anything up there? What's going on?
In terms of news flow, is there anything that you need to know about? I mean, that's the question.
Oh, Glenn, that's a classic of... I haven't done any work, really. I can't...
I've been to the beach yesterday. It's just all a little bit, you know, not that important. All right, let me think.
I've been to the beach yesterday, and I didn't do anything. I didn't look at anything, really. So is there anything you want to know about? Because while you're asking, I'll Google it.
All right, you've got Goldman. Oh yeah, I did just Google this. Yeah, after Bitcoin's betrayal, Goldman Sachs is suddenly betting big on crypto and blockchain. Yeah, this happened earlier this week. Yeah. A lot of the big banks are doing this now. You know, after years of saying that cryptocurrencies aren't a big deal, or they're never going to get anywhere, or words to that effect, a lot of the big banking chiefs said that kind of stuff for years. Now they're all jumping on board. They're all getting involved. They're all setting up their own cryptocurrency services. Custodial services, so that clients of theirs can hold cryptocurrencies with their bank, that kind of thing. So there is very much a feeling at the moment that it's starting to become part of, you know, general finance, the general finance world. Now, of course, that could still turn around if the US government turns so much against cryptocurrencies that it decides to put it in very stringent regulations that are tantamount to a ban. You know, I still do think that's a possibility, particularly with, you know, a very volatile president in charge who has made it very clear he hates cryptocurrencies and Bitcoin on a number of occasions. But nonetheless, the big banks have clearly decided that the risks are relatively small of that happening. And so therefore, they're pouring money now into setting up their own cryptocurrency services, try and make it part of the mainstream.
Which is
to be welcomed.
I'll be interested to see what happens with the elections, you know, because I think now this new lady that's come in, what's her name? Camille Biden's running mate VP Camille Harris.
Camilla Harris.
I don't know how to pronounce her name, Kamala Harris. Yeah. I think she's a... I liked her previously. When she stood down from the running, I was very disappointed. I really did like her, and I thought she's really down to earth, and she connects. And then she stepped down. I thought, what a disappointment. Because everyone else in the running, pretty much, was like an old white man. I thought, what did they connect with? An old rich white man, you know? Which is no good. I thought, they don't connect with most people in there. It's surprising.
Well, they connect with you.
Well, it's really offensive, actually. I'm mixed origin. I'm half Welsh. No, I'm more than half Welsh. No, but I'm an ethnic minority. I'm Welsh, England. So, I just thought she was very real, you know, and very there, connected. Not, regardless of, you know, actually her colour or her sex. When she spoke, she made some sense, and it connected, you know. I thought, right,
yeah.
She seems like she's on it. And then she stepped down from the running. I thought, what? But I'm glad she's involved. So it'll be interesting to see now, because obviously Trump has been accused of being sexist and racist. Now he's against a black woman who speaks a lot of sense and is very likable, I think.
She had to drop out of the presidential race because she wasn't that popular, funnily enough. It was like she started off as one of the front runners and then she just lost momentum with Democrat supporters, which is I don't quite understand why that happened, because as you say, she's pretty charismatic.
Yeah, Biden's the thing is, Biden, I mean, the sad thing is, Trump, listen, let's be honest, you can't handle another 4 years of Trump is ridiculous, I think. But the options is like, what's the alternative? Biden is a dodgy old man. He just seemed like, wow, he's already a shining, refreshing example of the way it should be. You know, it just seems like,
sedentary. The thing with Kamala Harris, yeah, some people think she might swing it now because she's got that kind of youthful, you know, exuberance that is so lacking in other candidates. But she's got a problematic history which doesn't please either the hard lefties or the kind of more centrist Democrats, because she was very tough on law and order back when she was involved with the justice system, you know, working in the justice system herself. She was tough on law and order in a way that would not please the far left, which is perhaps why some of her support drained away in the initial presidential race. But then on the other hand, she's done a turnaround now, and over the past couple of years, she's been really progressive and supporting lots of left-wing kind of policies. So that's put off a lot of the centrists. So now nobody knows quite what to make of her, because it's like she's done a turnaround. Is it a genuine turnaround? Has she had some kind of epiphany, or is she just trying to get elected?
Yeah. The odd thing is, I don't think it'll be. It's odd, isn't it? Because it's now more of a match, those two, for Trump. But of course, no Trump voter will be swayed by her. I don't suppose. They're not going for that. I suppose they're going for the fringe. You know, the people who are undecided.
Trump voters will vote for Trump. He's got 96% approval rate amongst Republican voters. So, exactly.
Doesn't matter what he does. You know, he could literally, like I said, he could shoot someone and he'd be fine. They'd probably applaud him and say, well done, Trump. That guy deserved the bullet.
So the only question is, can Kamala Harris excite people, Democrat supporters, enough to get enough of them out on election day? That's really what this is about. Not about winning over Republican voters. It's about people off their arses and into voting booths.
Well, I can't say we've gone off piste here, but I think, you know, there is one alternative, of course. It's a viable alternative. Kanye West. And I think...
he could split the vote, though, couldn't he? So if he does carry on with his...
He split sanities, definitely. Then anything else you want to Google or not?
No, just as I said, by the time people hear this podcast, I may or may not have sold Bitcoin and Ethereum, because they're looking, they've been looking distinctly dodgy, forming what looks like, particularly Bitcoin, forming what might be a sort of minor top pattern. And as I only bought in myself at about $9,300, there's a distinct risk that if I don't sell, if this pattern that I'm looking at right now,
let me ask a question. You're doubting the pattern is going to go upwards, but let me ask a question.
I'm just saying, if it breaks down, it might the price could easily fall all the way to where I bought, and I'd lose all my profit. So,
do you remember the first time you bought Bitcoin?
I'm wrestling with that.
Do you remember the first time you bought Bitcoin?
Yes, I remember it well.
When?
No, I don't remember it, but I know when it was, because I looked at my record.
When was it?
2013.
2013.
So I bought it when it was
Ben,
really
cheap. Do you remember
I said
that,
in and out,
that
in and out, mate.
That book. Do you remember that book I said? Buy, Write and Hold.
Hmm? The 100 baggers.
Yeah.
One.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you bought Bitcoin. It was around about what? Sub $100?
No, it was $300 first time I bought it.
Well, that wasn't in 2013.
Wasn't it 2014?
Yeah, the first spike up in $300.
Let me check it.
Literally, it started a rally. I'm looking at the chart, you know.
It started a rally.
It was 1:30 in October 13 at October 9th, December. It literally broke $200 in November 2013.
Yes, that's it. That's when I was first buying it. I'm looking at it now, yeah. November 2013.
It's $300 in November 2013. So literally, you more than 10 bagged that if you'd buy and held, or even topped up on the things.
If I'd bought and hold, yeah, I know. It's wonderful to say that in hindsight, isn't it?
Fact,
but try and go back to 2013 and try and remember how important
it.
You thought Bitcoin was.
Doesn't matter,
you
bought
even
one
heard of Bitcoin in 2013.
Buy, write and hold. But you got into it. You're 30 bagged it.
I'd have 30 bagged it.
Yeah.
You do realise I've made more than that. Look, if I'd bought one Bitcoin, as you're suggesting, right, in 2013 and held it, I would have made less money than I have made from Bitcoin in that time through my trading activities.
But how much hustling?
So I've made more money than I would have done if I'd 30 bagged it by just holding a Bitcoin from 2013.
You could have done that as well, but look how much less hassle you would have had.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, you've got a good point. The hassle has been a lot. it was so much hassle that I had to write a book about how much hassle it was. It's true. So, yeah, there's a lot less hassle involved in just buying and holding something. But you've got to remember, in 2013, see, nobody can even remember what they thought of Bitcoin in 2013. I don't reckon you'd even heard of Bitcoin in 2013. I'd only just heard of it. It didn't really seem like something you were going to put a lot of money into.
The first time I heard of it, I was looking to buy in some, and I couldn't even figure out how to buy some. But I remember it was around about $500. And I remember that. I thought, what? For one Bitcoin? I've never heard of it. I can't buy it, really. And it's $500 more. I thought, that's nuts. And now it's $9,000. What? So, yeah. And so I think that almost barrier to entry was probably a good thing. Because, you know, most people couldn't buy it. But then all of a sudden you get more people getting access to it and all that. But, yeah. Okay.
Everything looks easy with hindsight.
Yeah.
You know?
Times. But if you bought it, I say, yeah. It's not a bad thing, is it, really? 30 bags, even from there.
It's just like, you know, people say that, but the problem is, right, everybody had that attitude in 2017 when it came to cryptocurrencies. People who weren't buying Bitcoins, because there were so many brand new cryptocurrencies that were going to change the world in 2017, people started buying them on exactly, you know, and they were buying them to hold in exactly the way that you've just suggested I should have done with Bitcoin.
There are
most of those
most
of those cryptocurrencies just went to nothing. They pretty much ceased to exist since then, you know. So a lot of people, probably including a lot of people listening, lost a lot of money on a lot of very, very crappy little cryptocurrencies back in 2017. And back in 2013, Bitcoin felt like it could well be one of those. So it didn't necessarily make sense to people to put, you know, more than a few quid into Bitcoin at that time, because it just seemed like, to most people, it seemed like a bit of a no-hoper, a fad, a phase. Even now, people are still saying it's a bit of a fad sometimes. I think they're wrong.
Highly overpriced. No, I think Bitcoin knocks. It's like the carry trade. It's like the standard. It's like the US dollar, isn't it, of crypto. So that'll still always be there, pretty much, I think, as the one.
Standard.
Yeah. Well, it's still, you know, some indexes, so you have to trade via Bitcoin. You transfer to Bitcoin first, and then isn't that the case now or not?
Say that again, transfer?
Don't most people, you know, transfer into Bitcoin first from dollar or from pounds or from fiat to Bitcoin first and then start buying other stuff then? That's the first.
Yes.
I mean, when first people start trading,
that's true, but that's becoming less and less the case as a lot of the crypto exchanges are forging better links with the banking system. Yeah. People are, it's getting easier and easier basically to put your money straight into whatever cryptocurrency you want rather than going via Bitcoin. So Bitcoin is starting to lose its role there in that respect.
Yeah, yeah. But isn't it still 70% of all trades go through Bitcoin? Is that the case or something?
I'll have to look it up, but yeah, it's the point is it's decreasing because there are so many ways now to get into straight into the other cryptocurrencies. So in the longer term, that's not necessarily a reason to hold it. But there are many other reasons to hold it, which we can go into.
Bitcoin dominance got it here 60%, 59.7%.
Yeah, which is a lot lower than it has been.
Yeah, it was last time I looked at it. Yeah, I think even a couple of years or a year back, it was like 70%. So yeah. Okay, Graham, listen, it's only me and you listening now, and we're starting to peter off as well. So thanks.
All right.
We'll speak to you next week.
Okay, bye.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets. In the last 24 hours, they are at 5, non-standard finance. Where is that? Up 20% of 4.6 pence. At 4, 4D Pharma. It's 8.5%, 78 pence. At 3, Supply at Me Capital. Up 15 or 16% of 0.128. At 2, N4 Pharma. Down 10.9% to 11.25. And at 1... Graham's on the podcast, Deltic Energy. It's up 5.56% at 0.95 pence. Okay, top five most liked RNSs are as follows. At 5, Dev Clever Holdings, director, shareholder. At 4, Zenith Energy, completion of financing. At 3, Asia Met, link to investor call and Q&A. At 2, Smart Space Software, sale of enterprise software business. And at 1, N4 Pharma, positive COVID-19 in vitro study results. And that's resulted in a big rise yesterday, of course. 12th, wasn't it? Yeah, last 24 hours. And it shot up yesterday, I think 25% of that. Let's check the chart. Bigger than that. It was like 58% yesterday. So a nice rise there. And day before was like... big chunk as well, 14, and then before that 17. Wow, that's done 20 about 80% in one day, 90% in the last 3 or 4 sessions. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos appreciado.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.